Please, Court. My name is James Hunt Miller, representing the appellant, Amy Marsh, a disability claimant. This is the second time this case has been before this court. In the previous time, the merits of her disability claim, Judge Gold authored an opinion on sharing this, remanding to Social Security for further deliberations. Results of those deliberations, as I've talked about with counsel, are not before the court, and I just wanted to let the court know that as a result of that remand, she was granted disability payments for that period, and that was 11 years after she filed her application. And I think that ties into one thing I'd like to talk to you about this morning, which is that Judge Browning, you noted in the lawyer's lounge, noted that it's a privilege to be serving on the court where it's a process of improving the rules for dispute resolution. And I think here the court has an opportunity to improve the rules for dispute resolution about substantial justification in each context. And that's where we are now. This is only about each year.
That phrasing makes it sound like you're asking us to change something about our precedent, but I didn't take you to think we needed that in this case.
No, I'm not asking for a change, just more guidance improving the rule. Because the rule gets boiled down to the word reason allowed for substantial justification, even though the statute spells out a more detailed rule. And I think that, unfortunately, boiling it down to just reasonableness is a little bit too subjective and leaves too much room for subjectivity in judges and also for lawyers who are defending AJ decisions with errors. And I think a rule that
is the standard substantial justification or substantially justified?
I'm sorry, yes, I'm using those terms interchangeably, just as a way of talking. That's right. I was going to mention that in District Court Judge Breyer's opinion on this, denying each of these because the government's positions were substantially justified. At the very end of his decision, he said he found that ignoring the treating physician's opinion here in question was harmless, but the Ninth Circuit found it was not harmless, and he drew from that the idea proving that reasonable minds could differ. To me, that's pretty subjective. And also, I want to mention that I worked at OGC many years ago, Post-Ed Council works. And in the process, we're sort of randomly assigned cases to defend or make a decision not to defend. And initially, that's just a decision of the individual lawyer. The default decision is, of course, we'll defend. But in certain cases, if the individual lawyer thinks it may be indefensible, he makes a decision about that and attempts to convince higher-ups about not defending and asking for a voluntary remand. I think lawyers in the same position now could do better with a slightly more articulated rule.
So I don't understand why you're arguing this way. It seems like you have Tobler and Meyer and Gutierrez all from our court all saying that the government cannot defend a position that is unjustified, not substantially justified, even if there is a harmlessness factor. You can't justify something that went wrong below and then say it's harmless, you're not supposed to do that. Why are you just relying on the case that we already have? It sounds like you're asking us to do something new or depart from something which is a much bigger request than I don't understand what you're doing.
Yeah, I'm sorry. The only reason I'm pushing it this way is because I understand from the rule about bringing arguments to the court here today is that you've read the briefs to understand the cases, and I don't want to dwell on what I've already given. It's just providing perspective for this idea about improving the rules for a dispute resolution. So,
why did you tell us what is the point in the litigation you think where the government was substantially justified? Focus on that. I realize there are several points, but what is your best argument?
Well, the idea that it would be substantially justified to completely ignore a treating physician's opinion, I think,
books that's about this one, this was a fleeting decision?
No, no. I mean, it was argued, but just for a chance where I found otherwise.
Well, but the fact that they lost at one point, I mean, you wouldn't be here if the government had lost. They won. You would, you know. So there must be cases where they argue something and lose, and there's still no fees because the position is substantially justified. To say, oh, just buy one otherwise doesn't help you any, doesn't advance the ball at all. You have to persuade us that the position they took was not just wrong, but it's not.
Well, there's another wrinkle to that as well.
I'm sorry?
There's another wrinkle to that issue as well.
You're giving up on the first one?
No, I'm just saying that that was not the position taken at the administrative level. They just didn't say anything about the treating doctor's opinion.
And wouldn't they have to say something about how they were treating that opinion, even if he wasn't a treating physician? I mean, they would have to address a treating physician, they have to explain why they're not giving a controlling weight if they're not. But for any physician, they have to say something about it, don't they?
Well, I guess you would think so, but perhaps even if they didn't, it could have been harmless. That's their main argument. And I would like to put forward the idea that since a treating physician's opinion can be given controlling weight in certain circumstances, it would almost never be substantially justified just to ignore it.
But they take the position, this was not a treating physician, we don't think it was a treating physician. It's not clear cut. It was a treating physician, it's not somebody who went to on a long term basis and repeated this and so on. Why wasn't that a debatable point? And you agree that if it's not a treating physician, the amount that they need to say, the ALJ needs to say about it is much less, if anything at all.
Yes,
So they say, well, look, ALJ didn't say anything about it. We're defending it on the ground. But he's really not a treating physician. Why is that unreasonable?
I think it's borders on the absurd to say he's not a treating physician. He treated her over a period of years, both before and after the notes were offered. He obviously prescribed her various medications, gave her ideas about alternative treatments, considered her overall condition, gave opinions about her condition and how he looked to her over a period of time, and not just as I'm not sure, but I think I would say over the period of 5 years between 2001 and 2006, there may have been five visits, there were some visits later as well.
I thought there were like 13 visits in the 3 year period, is that not right?
I guess I'm not sure. But in any case, I can't see how anybody could even argue that he was not a treating physician. It just didn't make any sense. And that's another reason physicians were not substantially justified. It seems very much a post-op justification for a mistake, but it doesn't make any sense. The post-op justification, ALJ said nothing. The ALJ didn't seem to recognize that she even had any treating physician at all.
Could have been in the house last year on the same.
Yes, I will. Thank you.
Any more from the government?
Good morning. May it please the court, Eleanor Coder on behalf of the acting commissioner. I just want to address a couple points straight from counsel's opening arguments and the court's questions. With respect to the subsequent allowance in this case, that is June, I thank counsel for his professional courtesy in raising this issue to me yesterday. Under the Supreme Court's guidance in Shalala v. Schaefer, and I have the site for that because it's not cited in our briefs, the Supreme Court is clear that what happens on remand is not relevant to the question of substantial justification. That's also precisely the point in the Ninth Circuit's decision in Flores, which we did cite in footnote 5 of our brief. Going to the issue that Judge Freeland asked regarding Tobler-Meyer and Gutierrez, those cases do concern the agency's obligation to have substantial justification both at the agency level.
But what's the substantial justification at the agency level for not saying anything about Dr. Bintop?
Right, so the district court did not use its discretion in finding that there was substantial justification at the agency level. That's on pages 4 and 5 of the district court's order. Primarily, as Your Honor referenced, Judge Friedland, that not everything a doctor says is a medical opinion. Whether this was a medical opinion is a dispositive issue. Whether this was a treating physician is relevant, whether there was an error at the agency level, but it also goes to the harmlessness.
So, okay, let's separate out the issue. So, first of all, I'm not sure that Judge Breyer really addressed whether the agency was substantially justified at the agency level. I understand him to be talking about the substantial justification in the appeal.
I would disagree, Your Honor. On the bottom of page 3 of the decision, which is also page 3 of the excerpts of record here in this agent appeal, the court says it's thinking about the two main phases of litigation. First, whether the ALJ erred in omitting Dr. Batat's note, and second, whether the omission was a harmless error, so that's the litigation position. The court then continues on line 3 first, all the way over to page 5 until we get to 6.
Right, first, the commissioner's defense of the ALJ's omission, blah, 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 blah. So the defense of the ALJ's omission seems like the argument to the district court, not whether the ALJ's omission was justified in the first place.
I do appreciate your point, and we did evaluate this closely. Under the Supreme Court's guidance in Hensley, which is a reasonableness case that the district court cited on page 3, the appellate court has to have, it just has to get the gist of what the district court is saying. So, and I think that gist is here. The district court reiterates the agency's, the relevant issues to whether the agency errs. So that's the Howard v. Barnhart case. That's on line 13. We also have the up on line 11, the ALJ not accept the opinion of any physician that's briefed and considered inadequately supported. Going up again to line
18. Okay, so let's say he is talking about that. So, okay, the ALJ doesn't need to accept the opinion of any physician, but doesn't the ALJ need to explain why it's not accepting the opinion? Say something about it. How can that not be our clear law?
So, the regulations require, also to answer an earlier question, the regulations do require the ALJ to articulate why he is rejecting or the weight given to opinion evidence. However, an opinion of disability is carved out from the definition of a medical opinion. So it's a,
but wouldn't the ALJ have to say, I am disregarding this because I think it's the purpose of the commissioner or the realm of the commissioner and not this doctor, or this is how I interpret this, I think it's an ultimate conclusion. I mean, the ALJ said nothing about Dr. Batat or actually several other people who had examined this patient. So I don't understand how that was a substantial justification at the agency level, which is a separate question from the appellate arguments that might involve harmlessness.
The regulations wouldn't require the ALJ to explain why he wasn't addressing certain evidence. And this is precisely the difficulty with the substantial justification inquiry. It's an objective standard. It doesn't require the court to have evidence that the ALJ was thinking about certain evidence and specifically disregard it. That would be a subjective inquiry as to this particular ALJ. Substantial justification asks whether an ALJ viewing the body of evidence in this voluminous record would reasonably view this as evidence that didn't require commenting. And there's two main reasons here why, and that's because this was not a medical opinion, because it was a statement of disability. We know that from both the words on the page and that particular note in question, as well as the context in which it was offered. And the second reason is because the note was, not significant or probative, and that's not a harmless error analysis. That's the Ninth Circuit case law in Howard v. Barnhart.
So, looking at this, the opinion itself of Batat, so I think ER 498 is the, maybe the best one. So, it says the patient has chronic hemorrhagic bursitis to the point that she's pretty much non-functional. She also finds herself not to be able to concentrate enough to do office work. And so, then it goes on to say she appears to be disabled, but why are the first two sentences not an opinion that has to be taken into account?
They actually did find that hemorrhagic bursitis was a severe impairment. They also limited, skipping to the second sentence, limited the claimant to simple repetitive tasks, equating to unskilled work because of her subjective allegations of difficulty concentrating.
But they said nothing about this the idea that her treating doctor says that she's non-functional. Now, I know you think it's not a treating doctor, but even an examining doctor who says she's non-functional, isn't that something that should be
mentioned? No, because of an opinion, a statement that a claimant is non-functional. It is reasonable to view that as equivalent to a statement that a claimant has no function, which is a statement that a claimant is disabled. A medical opinion is a judgment about the severity and the functional effects of an impairment and their ability to work. To say that someone is non-functional is reasonably read as a statement of disability, which is reserved to the commissioner. There's also a high degree of uncertainty and ambivalence in these notes from Dr. Bertot regarding whether her impairments were even legitimate, and he says that it's sometimes difficult to tell for sure. Seems to be disabled, or excuse me, appears to be disabled, pretty much non-functional. The commissioner's regulations define a medical opinion as a judgment about a severity or an impairment, and these are not, it is reasonable to read these as not certain enough to be a judgment.
So do we have any case that says that if you think that it's an ultimate judgment of disability, you can just not say anything rather than saying, I won't consider that because I think it's an ultimate judgment of disability?
We don't have a substantial justification case saying that. What we do have is the merits.
That you have to say, I'm disregarding it because it's an ultimate conclusion.
No, Your Honor. What we do have is the merits cases of Vincent V. Heckler and Howard V. Barnhart. Vincent V. Heckler is particularly analogous to this case. We cited that on page 32 of our opening brief. That was a treating physician's opinion. The court found that it was not significant or probative enough that the ALJ even had to address it. The same was true in the Kelly case, which we cited on page 33 of our briefs. I believe that was over a year's worth of notes. And in the interim, we have the late case spelled L-E, which we cited in our opening briefs as well. This has to do with the definition of a treating physician, but this is a fact-intensive inquiry as to whether a party is a treating physician.
There were five visits in 3 years. Am I right? There are more than 10 visits in 3 years?
You are correct that there were 13 visits. This particular note in question, which was the subject of both plaintiff's allegation of error and the court's remand, it had been 13 months since Ms. Marsh had come to see Dr. Bertot. In those 13 months, she had quit all of the prescribed treatment and preferred to treat herself from a natural approach. That's in the top of that note. She did not return for 9 months. She appeared that day solely for Dr. Bertot to certify her as disabled on a scheme form, and he did that for 6 months, requested that she return at the end of that 6 month period, and she chose not to. So it is a fact-intensive inquiry as to whether he was a treating physician on this date. And that's quite similar, again, to the facts in Vincent, where the treating physician there was offering an opinion as to the claimant's present functional abilities, and yet hadn't seen the claimant for some time, and in that intervening time had developed additional impairments and strokes in that case. And here there was a development of fibromyalgia, which was also significant to the record.
So in this case, what we're looking at is whether or not counsel for Ms. Marsh is entitled to attorney's fees. And your argument, which is very cogent about substantial justification for all of this, is not addressing where there is a fault line for what's unusual. Term that some of the cases had used, and what is just the argument that was used below. So how is it that the court should be looking at what is substantial justification to deny fees under the statute?
The court is examining whether it was reasonable for an ALJ to view this record and to not see this treatment note as triggering the regulatory obligation to discuss opinion evidence, whether that was a reasonable act. And we argue that it was not a medical opinion, it was a statement of disability, it was not significant or probative, it did not add to the record in this case, as I mentioned, the diagnosis was already accommodated by the ALJ. concentration difficulties. The only thing that was not accommodated was Dr. Bertot's certification of disability. That's carved out from the opinion evidence in the registration case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You have a minute and a half left.
Yeah, just thinking of, I guess it's obvious, forgive me, it's true there is no case saying that a treating physician's opinion must be addressed or even acknowledged, but there is a regulation that does actually require that. So,
is there any authority saying that if it's not a treating physician, this is something expressing an opinion, that's an ultimate conclusion? That the ALJ must say, I'm not considering it because the ultimate conclusion is reserved to the commissioner. Anything that says that?
I'm not sure. I think maybe not.
Why is it reasonable for them to take a position that the ALJ take a position that I'm not required to address it? I see it. But isn't it clear here that Dr. Bertot speaks to questions that are the ultimate? Krishna, he says she's disabled, and why is the ALJ justified in saying I'm not going to say anything about it? Because obviously this is something that goes to the ultimate conclusion. It's a proper function of an expert.
Yes, that's correct. That's kind of his realm. But it's a lot more than that. Than just she appears to be disabled, so there's a lot more to deal with than just that one statement, which is kind of his realm. I would like to suggest the court, in Judge Gold's previous opinion, he said, I am unable, could not state that the error was harmless. It was a kind of a limited holding to send the case back. I think a parallel ruling here, that the court could not find that the errors made were substantially justified, or the lack of findings were substantially justified, would be sort of a parallel ruling.
I'm sorry, but you said earlier that there isn't a case that says that the ALJ must give reasons for not adhering to a treating physician. Isn't Batson v. Commissioner of Social Security, Molina? Don't we have lots of cases that say that? What are you talking about?
Based on the regulation.
But those cases actually, there are a lot of cases, and I don't think they are turning on the regulation specifically, are they? Or whether they are or not, the regulation at the time said you had to do this. So I don't understand why you said there are no cases that say you have to discuss the treating physician's opinion.
Because, I'm not sure, but it seems like if an opinion is out of the doctor's realm and completely worthless, then it would be substantially justified. But we're not talking about that situation here.